My name is Wenfei Fang. I work at Harvard University, and today I won't be talking about the lives of these four people. I'll be talking about short-GRBs. I just wanted to put them on the title slide to highlight the key people that dabble in short-GRBs at Harvard and who will all be here at some point this week. Is this the laser pointer? No. Of course, you know Ido, Ashley's daughter. She works on radio transients, so she's an expert in all things radio. Rafaela Marcucci will be here next week. She works on X-rays. She's an expert in X-rays, all things X-rays. Ryan Chornack leads our PanSTARRS effort, and he works on optical spectroscopy. I encourage you to come talk to any one of us. We're very friendly people. Okay. Today I'll be talking about observations of short-GRBs, and everything that we can learn from them. In particular, I'll be focusing on beaming angles, the energy scales, and also the environment. Putting these events into context. We know that long-GRBs are due to the collapse of massive stars. We know that because they're associated with supernovae. That's the smoking gun that brought about this direct link. Short-GRBs are not associated with supernovae, so we know that they're likely not due to massive stars. The emerging progenitor model is the merger of two neutron star binaries, and I will go over many lines of evidence that point to this as the predominant progenitor model for this population. This is the toy model of a gamma-ray burst. We have some sort of progenitor that explodes an environment. This is an example of a short-GRB host galaxy, and the circle is just the location of the burst after it faded away. We have some sort of progenitor that gives rise to a central engine. It could either be an accreting black hole or a highly spinning magnetar. That central engine gives rise to a relativistic outflow. That outflow is magnetically shocked or internally shocked, depending on the nature of the outflow, and gives rise to this prompt gamma-ray emission, and that's what the gamma-ray satellites trigger on, is this prompt spike. The remaining portion of the outflow goes on to interact with the circumburst medium and creates this afterglow emission. That's synchrotron emission, theoretically observable in X-ray down to radio wavelength. This looks like a very simplified picture. There's many open questions just on this single slide. The situation is especially dire for short-GRBs because the data is so sparse. The quantities I think we really can make significant progress on now with available data now are the following. The beaming angles. What are the beaming angles of short-GRBs? What is the geometry of the outflow? What is the energy scale? What is the gamma-ray energy? What is the kinetic energy of the outflow? What are the true energies? The circumburst density. What kind of media do these bursts explode into on sub-parsec scales? Finally, of course, perhaps the most fundamental question, what is causing these bursts? This really requires a detailed study of the environments, so putting these bursts into context. How do we use the observations that we have available to actually make progress on these questions? Well, for the geometry of the outflow, evidence for collimation comes from one single signature in the afterglow light curve, and that's called the jet break. That's basically just the steepening observed in a single light curve. This has huge implications on the energy scale and the rates, the true rate of events. It's very important to constrain the collimation of short-GRBs. We can also move to multiple wavelengths and learn about the energy and densities. We know that the afterglow radiation is synchrotron, and it's very well modeled. This is a toy synchrotron spectrum, and each of these break frequencies, knowledge of these break frequencies, as well as the peak of the spectrum, actually allows us to constrain the physical parameters of the burst, so the isotropic equivalent energy and density. If we're able to sample as much of the spectrum as possible, then we're able to actually directly constrain these parameters. And finally, the nature of the progenitor. This really requires putting these bursts into context. So what kind of galaxies do they explode into? So exploring demographics, how many of them are late type or spiral galaxies versus elliptical galaxies, how many of them explode in the middle of nowhere. The stellar population characteristics, things like masses, ages, metallicities, that's very important to understanding what type of stellar population this burst came from. And finally, burst locations. So if we think that the short GRBs are due to neutron star binaries, we expect that some of them will be kicked some distance away from their place of origin. And so investigating things like the location of the burst with respect to the host light distribution and also the physical location is very important. And so doing very detailed studies of the environments is the key to understanding the progenitor. So as you might expect, the GRB community is well equipped with what are called target of opportunity programs. So following the detection of a burst, there's this very established programs at various institutions across the world in multiple wavelengths. And so these are our particular programs at Harvard. We have optical and near-infrared follow-up with Magellan in Chile and Gemini North and South. And this is for optical imaging and spectroscopy of both the afterglow and then also late-time follow-up of the host galaxies. We have Chandra for high-resolution X-ray imaging. And probably our most unique capability at Harvard is our program with the EVLA, targeted for short GRBs. And that's really pushing the boundaries in terms of radio sensitivity. And I just like to highlight that the reason we chase after the afterglow is twofold. One is obviously the afterglow of physics. So there's lots of physics in the decay rate and the multiband spectrum. But another thing is the localization. So if we actually localize the burst in the optical, we can and detect an optical afterglow, we can locate that burst to sub-arcsecond precision. And that's extremely important in not only associating that burst with the host, but also calculating things like precise offsets. So that's those are the two reasons, main reasons we engage in that chase. Okay, so the first part of my talk is the geometry of the outflow. So how beamed are these short GRBs? This is just an introductory slide in case you don't know why we look for jet breaks. So this is what the light curve looks like, and the break is just this observed steepening. And it occurs because imagine you have a gamma ray burst, and in the rest frame, it has an opening angle theta jet. And because it's relativistically beamed, as an observer, you're only subject to a very small portion of the jet. But as the emission becomes less and less relativistic and goes to lower Lorentz factors, you'll be able to see more and more of the jet. And so eventually, you'll be able to resolve the whole thing and even portions wider than the jet itself. And so this will manifest itself as a steepening in the light curve. And that will happen at when theta jet is about 1 over the Lorentz factor. And so this jet break is very, very important to constrain, because with the time of the jet break, information on the energy density and redshift, we can directly get this opening angle. So this search has been relatively successful, I would say, for long GRBs. So this is kind of a montage of many jet breaks seen in the X-ray and XRT light curves. And so this feature, the steepening at about 1 day for all of these long GRBs, has led to a really nice opening angle distribution. So we see that long GRBs are pretty highly beamed with a median at about 7 degrees. So we know that long GRBs are very beamed. The picture is much less clear for short GRBs. So this is one recent example from this year, 11-10-20A of a short GRB. This is the X-ray light curve of this burst. You can see the initial XRT data and red points is fit really well with just a single power law. But we were able to actually trigger Chandra and get much deeper sensitivity in the X-rays. And we were able to recover this jet break. And with a jet break at 2 days, this leads to an opening angle of 3 to 8 degrees. And so that uncertainty in the break sorry, in the opening angle is just due to the uncertainty and the redshift. This is really important in the context of short GRBs because the only other convincing evidence for a jet break was back in 2005, 05, 12, 21, where they discovered a jet break at 5 days leading to an opening angle of 7 degrees. So already we have two pretty good examples of opening angles of beamed short GRBs. So this is what the entire distribution looks like for short GRBs. So we have the long GRBs in orange again, and the short GRBs are in blue. So here's 05, 12, 21 at 7 degrees, and then 11, 10, 20A, 3 to 8 degrees. And then these lower limits are just from the non-detection of jet breaks out to certain times. So this is the best we can do with XRT is put lower limits of about 5 degrees. And then these are some Chandra follow-ups from other bursts where we can put more stringent lower limits of 10 degrees. So the problem is that with XRT, because the afterglows are so faint, they fade below detection threshold before we might see a possible break. And because wider opening angles mean a later jet break time, we might just not be sensitive, or we're just clearly not sensitive to opening angles wider than 10 degrees. And so using something like Chandra to probe this region in the next couple years will be really important to quantifying this, what's going on here. Expectations on theoretical grounds from post-merger simulations predict opening angles between 5 and 30 degrees, but really where short GRBs lie is still unclear. Okay, so the implications of collimation are really great. So first, the energy scale will be much lower than the isotropic equivalent energy scale because of the beaming factor. So here's the gamma ray isotropic equivalent energy for all short GRBs with redshift that we're able to measure these energies for. And the median is close to 10 to the 51 erg. So that's that energy scale. Now, if we invoke beaming angles of about 8 degrees, then we decrease that energy scale by a factor of 100. And so the true energy that we're talking about is of order 10 to the 49 erg. Now, maybe this is wishful thinking, but there's two mechanisms of energy extraction, how energy is extracted to power a relativistic jet, either through neutrino, anti-neutrino annihilation or some MHD process. And they both predict kind of similar energy extraction, they both predict similar total energy output, but MHD can get to much higher energy. So maybe with more of these beaming angle constraints, we can try to start constraining the mechanism of energy extraction. Okay, the second major implication is on the rates of events. So the true rate, the observed rate, assuming no beaming of short GRBs is 10 per gigaparsec cubed per year. So that's here. So that's a robust lower limit just based on the observed rate. Now, simulations of double neutron star binaries as well as extrapolations on the galactic rate suggest a much higher rates of about 200 to 3,000 per gigaparsec cubed per year. So the amount that the rate is bumped up depends both on the beaming angle and also the fraction of short GRBs that are beamed. So if I say that 10% of short GRBs have beaming angles of about 8 degrees, then that will bump the rate up by a factor of 10. So we'll get to 100 per gigaparsec cubed per year. And if I say that all of them have beaming angles of 8 degrees, then I get to 1,000 per gigaparsec cubed per year. So it's pretty easy to get to reconcile these rates just based on beaming. Okay, so moving just from tracking one single short GRB in one wavelength and looking at the light curve to multiband analysis is we can actually, from this spectrum, so this is a short GRB model synchrotron spectrum, and these blue bands represent where we can sample the spectrum. So this blue band represents the radio, this represents the optical, and this represents the X-ray band. So We have 2 detections in the radio, 24 detections in the optical, and 45 in the X-ray. So that's where we stand with short-tier B afterglows. And from this, each of these break frequencies, plus knowledge of the peak of the spectrum, directly maps to the isotropic equivalent energy and density. So we can actually use, we can sample as much of the spectrum as possible and try to constrain those quantities. And in particular, we can use the X-ray flux, optical flux, and radio flux to actually constrain these 2 parameters. So we see that the X-rays actually can lie above or below the cooling frequency, this break frequency. And if we're above the cooling frequency, then the X-ray band is, the X-ray flux is proportional to the kinetic energy alone. And so from analysis of past short GRBs, we found that energy scale to be 10 to the 51 erg or so. From the optical flux and radio, they're both sensitive to a combination of the energy and density. So there's some degeneracies involved in here. So here are 2 golden examples back in 2005, where, so 050724, this is the SED, and with radio, optical, near-infrared, and X-ray detections of the afterglow, they were able to constrain these parameters really well. And this also had a late non-detection of a jet break at to very late times, at about 21 days. So they were able to put a robust lower limit on the opening angle of 25 degrees and inferred gamma ray and isotropic equivalent kinetic energy, so about 10 to the 50, 10 to the 51 erg. But perhaps most importantly, the density was very well constrained to low densities, 0.01 to 0.1. And then for 051221, this was the second golden example. And these are light curves in the radio, optical, and X-ray. So this is a very well sampled burst in all of these wavelengths. And this also had a jet break at 7 degrees and had an energy scale of about 10 to the 49 erg. And again, a very, very low density. So, you know, we actually, since these bursts, we haven't had such well-sampled bursts. We haven't been as lucky. But we're able to do more on a statistical sample because we have 20 or so now that we followed up in the radio. So this is all of the bursts that have been followed up since 2004, since the launch of SWIFT. Each of these triangles are upper limits in the flux. And this is versus time after the burst. So in some cases, we're able to get on within a few hours after the burst with the EVLA. And these very deep limits here are from the past year. And they're really pushing the frontier for sensitivity in the radio. And so these red points are just the 2 detections. And so the flux in the radio is sensitive to a combination of the energy and the density. And so how can we quantify this combination of parameters? So here I plotted the isotropic equivalent kinetic energy and density space. And so this is the parameter space that we can, that are allowed by our upper limits. So each of these dotted lines represents one of these upper limits. And so because they're upper limits, all the space above each dotted line is ruled out. All the space below each dotted line is permitted. So that's just for each of these lines corresponds to one of these points. And then these solid lines correspond to these 2 detections. So you can see that a lot of this parameter space is ruled out. How do we break this degeneracy? Well, we know a lot more from the X-rays. As I said, from the X-rays, we can actually get a direct measurement of the isotropic equivalent kinetic energy. And so that energy scale, the median energy scale, is about 10 to the 51 erg, which is this black line. So if I just take a cut at 10 to the 51 erg and I say that's the median energy scale and all of the bursts have something like that energy, and I ask what are the densities at that energy scale, I get this red histogram. So this is a cumulative histogram of the densities at that energy cut. And at 50%, you see that the median density, and this is an upper limit, is 0.02 particle per centimeter cubed. So this is the first time we've been able to do this on a large sample of bursts. So we can do the same exact thing in the optical. The optical is a little bit more promising, actually, for this analysis because the follow-up capability is so much greater. So these are all of the bursts that have been followed up, and all the triangles are upper limits, and all of the red points are detections. And these stars are actually hostless bursts, so bursts that seem to explode in the middle of nowhere. So in general, their optical afterglows are a little bit fainter than the ones that we actually find within a host galaxy. And just to translate, the median flux at about 10 hours after the burst is about 23rd magnitude. So these are very, very faint already. So again, the optical flux is sensitive to a combination of the energy and the density. So we can do the same analysis that we did with the radio. And again, plotted is the energy, isotropic equivalent kinetic energy density space. And each of these lines corresponds to an upper limit or detection in this plot. And again, all of the space below each dotted line is permitted. All the space above each line is ruled out. So again, if I take that kinetic energy cut from the X-rays at 10 to the 51 erg, and I do the same histogram at that energy cut, then I find that the 50% level for the density is now much lower. It's 0.002 particle per centimeter cubed. And so this is it's showing that the optical is actually much more sensitive to this analysis, and we're able to really constrain the densities to very low densities for a large population of bursts. Okay, so I've gone over a lot. I just wanted to give you the numbers that I think you should take away from this so far, just from the afterglow standpoint. So we know a fraction of them are collimated, possibly with 8 degrees. That leads to a beaming angle, beaming fraction of 1 over 100. So that reduces our isotropic equivalent kinetic energy to 10 to the 51 erg, and to 10 to the 49 erg, and then bumps up our rate to 100 to 1,000 per gigaparsec cube per year. And the typical density is very low. Okay, so switching gears to the environment. So what is the nature of the progenitor? Again, putting these short GRBs into context, kind of giving them homes and stories, and trying to figure out, you know, what happened. So this is a placemat of short GRBs. This is not all-inclusive, but this is just a sample of them, and just showing the diversity of environments. You see some come in the middle of nowhere, some occur on the edge of the disk of a spiral. So these are the things I'll be talking about, the demographics, what fraction occur in what type of galaxy, the stellar population characteristics, redshift, star formation rates, metallicities, masses, ages, what are the differences between that population and those for long GRBs, and finally the burst locations. So on subgalactic scales, where do the bursts occur within their host galaxies? So I just want to emphasize that short GRB redshifts are exclusively determined from an association with a host galaxy. They're fast fading and very faint afterglows, and so it's very difficult to actually get a spectrum of that, of the actual afterglow. And so association with a host is so important. And so this is just a smattering of short GRB redshifts that we've been able to obtain. I just want to highlight for people not experts in analyzing optical spectra, perhaps this example and this one down here are kind of two polar opposites. So this one is a star-forming galaxy. You can tell from this booming oxygen 2 line. So this is one of the features we look for ongoing star formation. Whereas this one is a old elliptical galaxy, and you know that from several of these absorption features. And also the shape of each of the spectra can actually tell us about the age of the galaxy. So we can learn a whole host of information from the spectrum. So this is the redshift distribution of long GRBs in black and short in blue. So you can see, you know, we're getting to about redshifts just over 1, and there's some upper limits based on sometimes we detect a short GRB, we're able to associate it with the host, but the host is so faint that we can't actually get redshift information. And so we're able to put upper limits on those bursts. And the median redshift is about 24, about 0.4, and the sample is 25 or so. So here are the expectations based on all of the things that we can, all the characteristics that we can study. So of a neutron star binary or neutron star black hole progenitor versus a massive star progenitor. So we know that for neutron star binaries, we don't expect any association with a supernova, whereas a massive star, we expect an association. For star formation, we don't expect any correlation with star formation for the merger case. And of course, we expect high correlation with star formation for the massive star case. And then again, we expect neutron star binaries to occur in older stellar populations. On the contrary, we expect massive stars to occur in younger stellar populations. And finally, for the offsets, again, we expect that if these bursts form from neutron star binaries, then some of them will be kicked some amount from their place of origin. So there's potential kicks and potentially large offsets. In this case, we don't really expect any offsets for massive stars. So environments are really, really key to understanding the progenitor population. So of course, we know that long GRBs have associated supernovae. We see this late time bump in many of the low redshift long GRBs. And short GRBs don't have any such supernova association. So there's been 5 short GRBs that have actually had really, really deep limits on the supernovae. So we know that they're not associated with supernovae. For morphology, we know long GRBs are exclusively associated with star-forming galaxies. And so this really links them to the death of massive stars. Whereas short GRBs, the first few were actually kind of irregulars, but we immediately knew from the first few short GRBs that they were occurring in older stellar populations or elliptical hosts. And these are the first 2, and we've since had 2 more. So 4 of them are in elliptical host galaxies. And so immediately we knew that they were distinct environments from those of long GRBs. And these are the current most up-to-date demographics of the population of short GRB environments. So we know that most of them are in spiral galaxies, a fraction are in elliptical. 20%, they're too faint, so we know that they're associated with the host, so we can calculate something like an offset, but we don't have spectroscopic information because they're too faint. And finally, this hostless population that I'll elaborate on at the end of the talk so these are short GRBs that just explode kind of in the middle of nowhere. And if we are able to, for these, we're actually able to calculate the probability of a nearby galaxy being a likely host. And so if we take the most likely host of the field galaxies for each of these bursts, then we find we're able to split into these categories. And this is just the resulting histogram, just assigning each of those hostless bursts to a host galaxy. And so you see the fractions don't really change that much. Again, we have most of them are in spirals. And so unless all of these inconclusive bursts are early type or elliptical galaxies, which is unlikely, then we know that most of them actually do occur in star-forming galaxies. Okay, but they occur in star-forming galaxies, but the characteristics of these star-forming galaxies of short GRBs are actually different from the characteristics of long GRB host galaxies. So this is a specific star formation rate. Short GRBs are these black symbols, and the red crosses are just field galaxies. And then long GRBs are these blue symbols. So they have lower specific star formation rates than the star forming hosts of long GRBs. They have higher metallicities as well, and they also have higher stellar masses. And so all of these characteristics put together point to a different origin than those of long GRBs. And one parameter I wanted to focus on was stellar population age. So this is a histogram of the ages of short GRBs in black and long GRBs in gray. And there's quite a range from about 0.3 to 3 gigayear. But in contrast, long GRBs have ages of about 60 million years. And so the median age is much higher. And if you assume that the progenitor is probably the same age as the stellar population from which it came, then you can get a very crude estimate of a merger timescale and use these numbers as a proxy for likely merger timescales. Okay, for locations, it's very important to actually estimate the location of the burst and the host. And so if we measure, you know, the center of this host galaxy and then actually calculate the angular distance between the host and the burst, we can get, and do that for many bursts, we can get a distribution. So this has been done for long GRBs, and this is a cumulative offset distribution for long GRBs, and this line is just where we would expect massive stars to lie in an exponential disk. So it's a host galaxy star formation model. So long GRB locations are consistent with where we would expect massive stars to lie. Short GRBs, on the other hand, so this is the long GRB distribution in red and the short GRB distribution in black. And these dotted lines are just neutron star binary models, so predicted offsets for populations of neutron star binaries. So these are the cumulative offset distributions. You can see right off the bat that they're very different and that short GRBs actually have much larger offsets than long GRBs. So the median offset is about 5 kiloparsecs for short GRBs and 1 kiloparsec for long. And there's marginal consistency between the neutron star binary models and the short GRBs. So these are all short GRBs with host galaxies. Also, we can do the same kind of analysis, but instead of looking at spatial location, we can look at the distribution of host light and analyze the location of the burst with respect to the host light. And so this is kind of a confusing plot, but basically anything that lies along this line, this one-to-one line, means that it's tracking the host light very well. Whereas anything that lies along this line means that it's this population is lies on very dense regions, dense light regions of the host, and anything over here means that it's tracking very diffuse regions of the host. So we can see that core collapse supernovae track their host light very well, and long GRB host galaxies lie in the most UV bright regions of their host galaxies, whereas short GRBs lie in the most UV and optically diffuse regions of their host galaxies. And so this just is more evidence that there's no ongoing star formation in these short GRB hosts, and also that they come from very, very diffuse regions of their host galaxy. So they don't originate in star-forming regions. Okay, and the last sample I just want to talk about is probably the most convincing evidence for kicks or for neutron star binary origin. So these are these so-called hostless bursts that seem to occur in the middle of nowhere. So these are optically localized bursts that we know the basically the pixel where the burst occurred. So these crosshairs represent the burst location. You can see there's nothing coincident, and there's just a bunch of kind of potential field galaxies nearby. And same with this one. So these are just two examples. Again, there's nothing coincident, and there's just a bunch of field galaxies around. These are HST images, so they go very, very deep. So there's three potential things that could be happening. One is they're kicked away from their galaxy or place of origin, so they have large offsets. Another is that we're just not detecting them, either because they have they're at very high redshift, so they're faint, or because they're very low luminosity, so maybe they could be closer, but they're just not very bright. In order to investigate this first option, we can calculate what's called the probability of chance coincidence for each of these galaxies. So we can ask, what is the likelihood of finding a galaxy that's unrelated to the burst? And in order to find a likely host, we want to minimize that probability. So if we do that for all six hostless bursts, and calculate a cumulative probability of chance coincidence distribution and plot that versus distance away from the burst, angular distance away. So we see close in, there's a low probability that there's host galaxies for these bursts. And then at something around 10 arc seconds, there seems to be a sharp minimum in this distribution, meaning that there's, if you go 10 arc seconds out, then for most of these bursts, you'll find a likely host galaxy. So you might think, oh, maybe this is just an artifact of galaxy clustering, or maybe this just always happens. But if we compare this to the distribution of short GRBs with host galaxies, so these are ones with very good host localization, we see that the most probable host galaxies lie within one arc second, and then there's no minimum at 10 arc seconds that we see for this population with hosts. And so this is very indicative of perhaps a highly kicked progenitor system. So this is the same plot that I showed you before of the offset distribution. This is the long GRBs in black and the short GRBs in red. And these models are, again, predicted offset models of neutron star binaries. And so if we fold in this hostless population and use the most probable hosts for each of those hostless galaxies, then this is probably the most provides the best agreement with these models that we've been able to recover to date. And I also just wanted to point out, these are two short GRBs that have X-ray positions only, but those so they're X-ray positions with Chandra. And so we were actually also able to get sub-arcsecond localization of these bursts, but they have no optical afterglow. And it doesn't seem like these offsets are any different from the normal population. So it's not like we're just probing a certain part of the population because they're optically selected. Okay, so just revisiting these expectations, all of the information that I've given you points to this as the predominant progenitor for short GRBs. In particular, I think the offsets is probably the most convincing argument. Okay, so this is just the summary slide. The story so far for the nature of the progenitor, what we know, short GRBs reside in mostly spiral galaxies, and a fraction of them are in elliptical galaxies, and substantial fractions seem to be highly kicked. Compared to long GRBs, short GRBs are very different in their stellar population characteristics. They have lower specific star formation rates, higher metallicities, and higher stellar masses. And for ages, they have a range of ages that could be a proxy for merger timescale from 0.3 to 3 gigayear. And finally, offsets. They have much larger offsets of about 5 kiloparsecs, and some of them have substantial offsets of 30 to 70 kiloparsecs. So yeah, I hope I've convinced you that these actually, you know, come from a very distinct population of progenitors than long GRBs. Okay, thanks.
Clearly, we have lots of questions.
That offset distribution is really interesting.
Yeah.
I guess if you had, instead of a neutron star, or a neutron star black hole, would you expect a very substantial shift in the predicted offsets to the left because you have higher masses and therefore a given kick? So is this a way of strongly distinguishing between double neutron star and even neutron star and relatively low mass black hole?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on the predictions of offsets for neutron star black holes. I would think that generally the kick comes from the birth of the second neutron star in these simulations. But I don't think that the kick distribution would be substantially different for neutron star black holes. But I'm not. Yeah, the mass. Yeah. That's true.
I think there is, and if you look at the papers, they differentiate neutron star. I mean, but I remember it not being as big as you might think. I can't remember back to that when I did it. So.
Also, for one-off events where we can actually do this, type of analysis, I think it would be difficult to say, you know, for this population, for this single event, you know, it's definitely from a neutron star black hole, but. You know, if a fraction of them are coming from neutron star black holes, it's certainly allowed in this model. Yeah.
A very nice review. For the neutron star mergers that you showed the models for, what was the merger time that you assumed, or what was the distribution?
For this?
Yeah. For example,
it's a range of merger timescales. I don't remember the timescales, but it's a reasonable range.
Are you asking from the theoretical models or?
Yeah, for the theory, right? Yeah, there's a distribution of merger timescales, kick velocities that are all.
So usually the population censuses gave, they had a kick and a merger time associated with each other, and then that's how you got this.
Yeah,
guy.
So it's a distribution of both of those, yeah.
Concerning the kicks, and I want to stress again that there is a population of neutron stars, particular the double pulsar is a prime example, that don't move at all. And this is a large fraction of them. And in this population synthesis, the paper that you are referring to, there was no, this population was not included at all. So you have to be slightly careful about this population synthesis. But my main point is actually going to your first slide. Can you go back to your first slide? Not the one with the pictures of the people at Harvard, but the one after that.
You don't want to see the picture. Yeah.
Yeah, this one. This figure is from BATSI. It's well known from 93. And the lines which are added to it are added to guide the eye, separating for long and short oscillations. In fact, in recent series of papers that we have done, what we've shown sort of conclusively that the long population does not go to zero at 1 second. The long population, the collapsed population extends with a final probability all the way to zero. And this means there is a contamination of collapsars in the short populations when you just take a temporal distribution. Now, even more important is the fact that this division line of 2 seconds, which is sort of so clear in this figure, depends very strongly on the detection window of the detector. And for BATSI, which is a hard window, relatively hard window, 2 seconds is about the right place where short or non-collapsar begin to dominate.
Yeah.
SWIFT has a completely different window. SWIFT has a window which is much softer, and in fact, SWIFT detects much fewer short GRBs compared to long GRBs, 1 to 10 instead of 1 to 3. So this is reasonable. One shouldn't take the division line measured in this figure for BATSI and use it for SWIFT, because it's a different detector, it's a different satellite, there will be a different division line. And the division line that, rough division line that we have found is between 0.7 to 1 second instead of 2 seconds. And this means that about 30 or more percent of SWIFT short GRBs, short in the sense of less than 2 seconds, are really of collapsar origin. And this induces a bias in many samples.
Yeah.
And one has to be very careful about this bias. One can actually filter this bias by looking carefully at the duration of the relevant burst and also at the hardness. Mm-hmm. One should be able to do this.
Yeah, okay.
So yep. If you see two events, for example, I'm just finishing. When you see two events which don't have, for example, these two guys that don't have a counterpart, they could have been events at a long GRBs collapse at very high redshift, which you simply don't see the host because it's a very distant host.
Okay, yeah. All right. So I understand there can be some contamination. We should take that 2 second line with a grain of salt because it was based on the BATSI distribution and now we're working with a different satellite. But just taking the SWIFT population of bursts that we followed up, I think the most convincing evidence that short GRBs don't come from collapsars are the non-detection of a supernova. These occur at low redshift, so we should be able to see a supernova if it's there. And in fact, we have 5 examples of ones like these, where there's deep limits on a supernova. And if I actually take your probability of collapse star versus duration distribution from your paper, and I ask what is the probability that none of them are collapse stars, that's 10 to the minus 3, so it's very low. But we know that they aren't collapse stars because there's no supernova. And so I have looked in every category from the environment standpoint, offsets, morphologies, everything, and I find no obvious correlation between duration and these properties. And I have looked. I think, you know, I've looked very carefully at especially that population between 0.7 and 2 seconds, and I don't see any difference. And I think you really can't argue with these non-detections.
Okay, I'm trying to remember my question. I had a comment and a question. So my comment is the theorist, which I think is, it's great to compare things to long GRBs, and you made a convincing case. I think we need to think more about what other types of events could produce short GRBs, and it's a hard problem. It's hard to get a short transient like this, because if you believe it's accretion, you need a very compact disk, and so you're almost already dealing with some type of very compact binary. The only thing people have thought of is maybe accretion-induced collapse of neutron stars, or maybe accretion-induced collapse of white dwarfs. I think as a community, we need to think more about what the other models that we could think about. And my question related to this is, so I mean, you can get, you know, if you were to plot, say, globular clusters or something on your distribution of offsets.
I actually don't have that.
We could imagine there being weird things going on.
Yeah, so that's another. I don't actually have. I have another version of this plot with globular clusters, but globular clusters basically span this, you know, they start kind of in the halo of their galaxy, so the offsets are much larger, so they kind of span this swath of space based on the mass of whatever galaxy you're talking about. So that's definitely feasible within this model. Maybe some of these highly kick bursts actually originated from globular clusters.
So you could have a population of globular clusters.
Yeah, there might be a population. Yeah. Yeah, I think, but the fraction of neutron star binaries that are actually formed in globular clusters, I think, is pretty low.
Sure, right. But in terms of, there's lots of other weird things we can...
Yeah, but other weird progenitor scenarios, I don't discount partial contribution from, you know, accretion-induced collapse or things like that, but I don't know if we expect them to be kicked as much. So maybe they could contribute to some of these, you know, lower offset things. Or if there's any other observational signatures you can think of. For those scenarios.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. The fact that you get these things so far away is hard to reconcile with other progenitor systems, because the kick velocities that you need over the timescales that you calculate, are only seen in these kind of compact binary mergers. Do you have any feeling as to, in the hostless population, whether or not you see systematically lower luminosity afterglows?
Yes.
They're really in the IGM rather than.
Yeah. So they're actually that optical afterglow plot that I had. They're systematically lower. So like a magnitude or so lower median. So they definitely have lower luminosity afterglows. This one. Yeah. So that if you just look at the hostless population, that's these stars versus the red dots. They definitely have lower luminosity afterglow. So yeah, it's indicative of probably a low density, either a low energy or low density environment.
No,
but keep going.
No, the other thing that I didn't really understand very well is when you calculate an offset from things that you don't see, from hosts that you don't see, do you associate the offset to the nearest galaxy? Or because I guess, you know, the probability of finding a galaxy at random in the sky depends on the luminosity of the galaxy.
So you're talking about the hostless bursts?
Yeah, when you include those hostless in your distribution.
Yeah, the ones that we don't see, so some low luminosity thing that could be there.
Yeah, so we have shown, if you do this in cosmological simulations, if you get above 200 kilometers per second, you get above this K velocity. These objects basically populate a field, kind of cosmological population that is not bound to any particular galaxy. And then they just, you know, what galaxy you associate with those in projection.
That's difficult. I think that's a difficult problem to tackle. I think this is not.
So the exercise is that you take all the galaxies in your image and you just ask, what's the probability of finding each one of them by coincidence, which depends on the separation from the position you're considering and how bright they are, right? Which is what you're saying. There are a lot of faint galaxies, and so their probabilities of chance coincidence are really high, and bright galaxies, depending on the separation, could be low or high. And so that's the distribution that Wenfei showed that had that very deep minimum at 10 arc seconds. You then say, I'll just associate them with those galaxies because the probability that those galaxies are there by coincidence is extremely low.
Well, but then and, that depends also on the redshift distribution. If you
it's all in projection, right? So you just take number counts of galaxies as a function of their apparent brightness, and you play it. If you had the redshift axis, you can go beyond, but we don't have redshifts for all of these galaxies. So you just do the projected probability of chance coincidence. And you just say, you know, if I find a galaxy there in the field that has a probability of 10 to the minus 3 of being there by coincidence, I'll say in a statistical sense that's probably the host galaxy.
Yeah, so for these, I'm not trying to associate, you know, single bursts and say that's definitely the host galaxy for this burst. I'm just saying, you know, in a more a population level, there's likely hosts at about 10 arc seconds. There, you know, that method is not foolproof.
I had another question. Could you comment on the inconclusive ones? I'm guessing that they're weak ones. It could be happening in a lower density environment, and so there could be a good fraction of those that are hostless if we knew more about them.
The inconclusive environments?
The inconclusive in your pie chart.
Yeah. So those are, that inconclusive just means there's a host there, there's a galaxy there. But I'm not able to say what the spectrum is. Or I'm not able to say what the redshift is or what the morphology is.
Are these bursts that have optical afterglows or?
Most of them do. Some of them, like 05-12-10, has an X-ray position, but there's only one thing kind of within the center, the air circle. And we have HST imaging for that, so we're able to say something about the surface brightness profile. But for some of these other bursts, so this inconclusive, actually all of them have optical positions.
Right, yeah. Okay, yeah. So the XRT only bursts don't even appear here.
Yeah, no. The XRT only bursts, some of them actually do appear. If I do the same pie chart for only optically localized or sub-arc-second localization bursts, the fractions are virtually the same. So if I include some XRT-only bursts where there's only one bright thing within the error circle, and it's probably the host, those bursts are included in this. But the fractions don't really change. Yeah.
All right, so it's really a follow-up to what Enrico and Ida were saying regarding the hostless. In the image, you have a few things that look like galaxies in the image, and you have this isolated point where the burst went off. But if you were to show us a field that is 10 times bigger, you know, would you have the same distribution of galaxies across the whole image or not? And so I guess if the answer is no, then the typical distance between the things that look like galaxies on the image is you would expect that to be the offset.
Yeah, I think we went substantially farther out than this image shows. So I don't think there would be any other minimum farther out from this.
Okay.
Yeah. So all of these have similar depths of 27th magnitude. So yeah, that's also, so all of them are HST. So they're basically the same limiting magnitude.
Just in the general discussion of the locations of the gamma ray bursts with respect to the hosts, I just wanted to point out there's also a population of calcium-rich transients that are being observed by PTF, which are systematically like 30 to 40 kiloparsecs away from their hosts. For all intents and purposes, they don't look like they're associated with any sort of neutron stars, probably some sort of white dwarf, thermonuclear explosions or something. But and I don't think they're related to short gamma ray bursts, obviously, but it's just an example of something where it's probably not related to neutron stars, but they're happening in a very interesting location.
Yeah, that is. That's also a very interesting population of transients. Yeah.
Following up Neil's question, so this pie chart had 36 members. How many short GRBs did SWIFT detect? Namely, there's a sample here that has no afterglow information of any kind.
Yeah, so there's 67 SWIFT short GRBs.
So that means, I think my interpretation of this is that at the factor of 2 level, you don't know what this pie chart of key is. They could be mostly in ellipticals, and you're biased against those because those are they're mostly ejected from ellipticals and you don't see the afterglows.
I'm not sure why the I guess unless it's a
well you miss
I don't know why that bias would work in that way like
the
non-detection
of
x-ray.
The ones that are kicked further out.
They're more massive and luminous. I don't know if they would have higher kick. So I don't know if that would work in but there is a missing population that maybe like a 40
that's a large fraction of the
except there are a good number of maybe 20% or so of bursts that just fall off really fast, and we've seen an XRT and they look even if they're far away from the sun, you look with, even a big telescope, you don't see them. So.
Yeah, that's also puzzling. Looking at, I guess, half of the X-ray light curves just kind of plummet before 1,000 seconds. So you get a position, which is useful, but for afterglow, for tracking the afterglow, that's difficult.
And this, what I speculated on earlier, which is kind of obvious, I guess, is just that those are ones in very low-density environments. There may be a lot of those.
Yeah. The thing is with, if we say the optically selected sample is biased, I think more, with the two Chandra examples I showed where there's an X-ray position, their offsets don't seem to be much different. But that's only two examples. So I think more of those would be useful, getting an X-ray position.
Any further questions? If not, let's thank Wen Fei one more time and all the speakers for the session.